Country Life on Midlands 103. Brought to you by W. Orshaw, Burlington Business Park, Tullamore. Your main supplier of New Holland tractors in the Midlands. WORshaw.ie.
Now, good evening and welcome to Country Life here on Midlands 103. MJ Cleary with you for the next hour, bringing you the latest from the Midlands and further afield from the worlds of agriculture, food and agribusiness. Now, thank you all for joining me, and a real touch of winter since I was speaking to you last week. Cold and wet for the last 7 days. The weekend looks slightly better with temperatures in the double figures at the moment. Slightly drier as well, and that's for Saturday and for Sunday. Now, on to this evening's programme. Plenty to get through as usual, and farmers are always interested in optimal nutrition for their animals. So feeds with a high energy concentration with good ingredients that will ensure animals thrive to their greatest ability. On most farms and in the majority of households in Ireland, there is another animal that is part of the family, but the same care may not always be given to their nutrition, and that is the family dog. A Westmead man has seen a huge gap in the market for healthy dog snacks. Leonard Green from Multifarnham has come up with dog treats that are made from grass-fed beef and seaweed, to name just a few of the ingredients. His products aid dog health, to include joint aid, and another one is a natural warmer. So if you're interested in the health of your dog, this is a must-listen-to interview later in the programme. Paul Malloy is a dairy farmer from County Offaly, and he's doing things a little bit different than most. He's selling milk direct from his farm in Boora. Boora Banya, as it is aptly named, is on the go since July 2021. But an unfortunate incident this time last year where criminals destroyed his equipment in an attempted burglary meant he had to cease trading for a period of time. He's back up and running now with bigger and better equipment, so we'll chat to Paul a little bit later to see how things are going in the direct milk sales business. I must say, Boora Banya is a really great name, really rolls off the tongue. Farm safety is a topic we revisit again and again here on the programme, and if chatting about it helps to prevent one even minor accident, then it's time well spent. It's an area we all get a little complacent with, and it's simply human nature really, but we all need to take care and ensure risk is kept at bay. Chagas is running the Be Safe programme, and the stats show that farmers are not as careful as they should be. In fact, 57% of farmers in a recent survey stated that they engage in unsafe farming practices on a regular basis. With more on this later, David Meredith will join me with some simple tips as to how you can farm in a safer manner. Now, as always, text the show with comments, thoughts or questions to 083 3010 103. Be happy to put anything to our guests this evening. To start the programme, the Irish Farmers Journal's Tullamore Farm is holding an open morning tomorrow morning on their farm just outside Muckla here in County Offaly. It's part of their Footprints Farmers programme. And this programme is all about carbon tackling. Tomorrow they're going to talk about red clover silage, acres, hedge planting and winter feed. Siobhan Walsh, Laois native, joins me now to give the details. Siobhan, many thanks for joining me.
Hi MJ, thanks for having me on.
You're more than welcome, Siobhan. Now, the open day tomorrow is on Tullamore Farm. We're all familiar with it at this stage. Lots of regular write-ups on the Farmer's Journal about it. Often talk to Adam Woods about the sucklers and the beef enterprise out there. But this is the other side of the coin. This is part of the Footprint Farmers programme. So can we speak about that for a moment, Siobhan? What exactly is this programme, please?
Yeah, so the Footprint Farmers programme is basically the Farmer's Journal, I suppose. We wanted to focus on farm sustainability, so we set up this programme, and we got 8 farmers across the country. They're from all different types of farms, beef, sheep, dairy and tillage, and they're from different parts of the country. And Tullamore Farm is one of those farms. If we're setting up a group, we said we're going to put our own farm in it. And basically, the programme is aiming to improve the sustainability of those farms. And when I say farm sustainability, I mean the economics, the environment and the social aspects of all those farms. So we want the farm to make money while working in harmony with the environment and giving the farmer a good quality of life as well. So basically the 8 farmers are featured in the paper. There's a page every week, and we're trying to create role models for sustainability in the paper that people can follow every week. And it's really back to basics, MJ. Like, a lot of the things that we're doing are very simple things that can make a big difference on your farm, whether it's soil testing or slurry testing. You know, simple things can make a lot of difference, and that's what we're trying to show with the Footprint Farmers programme.
So did you start off, Siobhan, by I know measuring carbon, it's a difficult concept or talking about this, or did you try and get some sort of an idea of maybe the carbon footprint of each farm and then the differences that you're going to make and how it's going to lessen that, or how, what's the methodology behind it?
Yeah, so we're still working on the footprint of the farm. It's very hard at the minute. The models, you know, aren't really made for Irish farms, so we're still working on that, but it's in progress. But what we did do was get a baseline of the soil carbon on all of these farms. So we first of all tested the soil for your normal NPK and the micronutrients as well, but then we tested the soil for carbon. So we went down to a depth of 30 centimetres. And on Tullamore Farm, for example, we found that we were storing nearly 5,000 tonnes of carbon in the soil. And there was huge variation within that. So Tullamore Farm, about half of the farm would have been in continuous tillage up to the time we took it over, so about 5 years ago. And we could see that on that part of the farm, there was only about 21 tonnes of carbon being stored in the soil. And as we moved to the fields closer to the yard where there was animals grazing, where there's farmer manure being spread, the soil carbon was much higher. So we had 97 tonnes of carbon per hectare. And if we go to some of the other footprint farms, there's a dairy farm, and on the grazing block, there's a soil carbon level of nearly 320 tonnes of carbon. So we're getting loads of good information out of this programme. And I suppose, well, you might hear the 21 tonnes in Tullamore is low. That's actually a really positive thing. Because when I talk about storing carbon in the soil, I'm talking about, we hear about carbon emissions and how agriculture has to reduce its carbon emissions. And all farms produce emissions. But all farms also have the potential to offset their emissions as well. So basically, carbon is stored in the soil. We grow a crop on the soil, you know, whether it's grass or spring barley or a cover crop, whatever it is, that crop takes in carbon dioxide from the air and it stores carbon then in the soil. So carbon, whether it comes out through the root, exudates, or whether we plough that crop back in or incorporate the crop back into the soil, it puts carbon back into the soil and stores that carbon and helps to offset emissions. Mm. So it's really important things to be measuring, MJ.
Yeah, and how exact, I suppose, or how far away are we from exact carbon measurement then, being able to tell exactly how much is in the soil and how much we could sequester over the course of a year?
So it's all very new, and I read about this all the time as part of my job, and the more I read about it, the more confused I am, and sometimes I think we're very near and sometimes we're very close. But to put some perspective on it, we've measured the carbon now on these 8 farms, and we'll have to go back. That's only a baseline. So we're going to have to go back in 3 years' time, and we're going to have to measure the carbon again, and then we'll have to minus one off the other. And if the carbon has increased, we've stored carbon in the soil. So I suppose a lot of things with carbon at the minute are very slow, but there's also other ways of doing it. So we plan to, our next step along the road on Tullamore Farm is to measure habitats and basically measure our hedgerows and our trees, because they can all store carbon as well. And we'll do that by satellite, but somehow we'll do it will also be by LIDAR. So it'll be technology like satellite from the air, and it'll use infrared technology to measure carbon. And hopefully there'll be something like that to measure soil carbon in time as well, because that'd be a lot quicker. But all of these things, MJ, are very expensive, and I suppose a normal farmer couldn't do it. And in the Footprint Farmers Programme, the Agricultural Trust are putting money into it, and MOCRA are also supporting it as well. So we have funding there to do some of these things to test on the farm, and we're trying to put the results out to the wider public then. But I suppose you or me couldn't do it on our farm. It wouldn't be practical.
Exactly. It's early days, Siobhan, but it's good work. There's no question about it. It's the way things are moving. In relation to your open day tomorrow, then you have a few different things you're going to be focusing on. But one of those, and it's a big one at the moment, especially with the amount of people talking about organics and moving into organics, that's red clover silage. This is a big, big hot topic conversation at the moment.
Yeah, so we sowed red clover silage last year on the farm, and we sowed multi-species swards as well. And like everyone else who sowed it last year, we did it through the scheme. And we only sowed it in May. It struggled, to be honest, in the dry weather, and we had a few weed issues with it. But we did get one cut of silage off it, and the amount of silage that we've got off it now Sean Diver, the farm manager, is going to use that to feed some of the triplet and twin carrying ewes. So I suppose tomorrow at the farm walk, we're going to find out what Sean's going to do with that red clover silage and how he plans to feed it. So we've tested all the silage on the farm. We have the pits tested as well, so the red clover, and the first and the second cut grass silage as well. So it'll be interesting to compare the three, and Adam Woods and Darren Carty will be there as well, as Sean, and we'll talk through all the winter feed plans and how we're going to manage that silage through the winter. And look, MJ, that's the things I was talking about, like the small things making a big difference. If you test your silage on your farm, you know, you find out a lot of things. Maybe your protein is high in your silage and you can afford to cut the protein in your ration. Or maybe it'll be the other way around. Maybe you need to increase the protein in your ration. But at least if you test it, you know, and you'll be more efficient in how you feed your animals.
And on the silage, the red clover silage, Siobhan, when you sowed that, was that oversown or was it reseeded? How did you get that in?
No, so we actually ploughed. We had where there was docks in the field, so we were afraid, so we said we'd plough it. So we ploughed it. It went in the middle of May. It went in at about 14 kgs, and it got two bags of 10-10-20 at the time. You know, you need to give it a bit of nitrogen to start it off and the P and K, but after that, then it hasn't got any nitrogen. And same with the multi-species sward as well. Got two bags of 10-10-20 at the time, and look, hopefully those. This is a big part of how we're going to cut nitrogen on the farm. We have a big focus on clover on the farm, and we're trying to see the red clover and the multi-species work to cut the nitrogen as well.
I see also, Siobhan, you're going to be talking about the acre scheme tomorrow. Is Tullamore Farm going into the acre scheme?
At the minute, we don't think we are, MJ, to be honest. We're a very productive farm, and a lot of the measures just aren't adding up to what we're doing. You know, we've a quite a high stocking rate on the farm, and every inch of ground is being used, so we'd probably have to take land out of production in order to benefit really financially from the scheme. But look, we're still doing things that can be, you know, that we would be doing if we were in the acre scheme. So one of the things that we're doing tomorrow, and a lot of farmers will be doing it next year as part of acres, is we're planting a hedge. So this is kind of one of the things that we're trying to do on Tullamore. We planted a bit of a hedge last year, and now this year we're planting it. We have a new shed, and we're planting it around the new shed there at the minute. So we're going to do a demonstration on how to plant that hedge, and give people advice tomorrow as well, on how they might go about it next year, because there's 30,000 farmers going into acres next year, and there's probably a lot of them are going to take up the hedge planting option in that.
Yeah, there's a lot of good information tomorrow, Siobhan. I'm going to have to leave it there. But you were saying if people are interested, when and where do they meet?
Yeah, so 11 a.m. tomorrow we're starting at. So meet at Mukla Community Centre, and we're bussing people down. It's only a 2-minute drive down to Tullamore Farm. It's just because of the weather, we can't park in the fields. So 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. tomorrow. And come dressed for the weather, but we have a shed there anyway in case it rains. And look, loads of information to be got. And 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. anyway, meet at Mukla Community Centre, MJ.
Super stuff. Thanks a million for that, Siobhan.
Thanks, MJ.
Lovely. A lot of stuff there, I have to say, tomorrow on the Tullamore Farm. A lot of interesting content and all on point as well. It's all everything that's happening at the moment. Very interesting. The whole area of carbon sequestration, how much carbon can the soil take in? There's just so much information out there, and we're not sure how valid any of it is at the moment. And it really is kind of hard to negotiate, I suppose, for agriculture when we're unsure of that, because that's the crux of it all. And if we could get to a place where we knew how much carbon there is stored, or how much we can store or take from the atmosphere, then we would be in a far better negotiating position. But it is coming down the track. And you're very welcome back to Country Life here on Midlands 103. Now we're moving on to dairy, but it's dairy with a twist is what I'll say. I have Paul Malloy from Boora Banya on the line. Paul, many thanks for taking my call this evening.
No worries, how are you, MJ?
We're going good, Paul. Bora Banya, as I said, is your business. You're located in County Offaly and you're a dairy farmer, but unlike most dairy farmers, you're selling your milk direct to the public. Now, lots of our listeners will be familiar with you. I know you were on a billboard here in Tullamore back a year and a half or so ago, part of the Cultivate Loan programme, and you were right here at the train station. You get some great publicity from it, and people are familiar with your story anyway because of some disappointing news, I suppose, that happened to you maybe about a year ago. We'll get on to that in a minute. But we'll rewind the clock for a few minutes, Paul, and we'll talk about back in the day when you first set up the business selling milk direct. What prompted it, or where did you get the idea from?
A friend of mine just sent me a link to an article that somebody that was doing something similar up in County Antrim, and I just called up to see them in August of 2020, and I liked the idea, and I, after that then I went on a kind of a study trip to over to the UK to look at more vending machines over there to get an idea of the type of machines I wanted and the scale I was going to go at.
And the way you went at it, Paul, wasn't willy-nilly, I suppose. People could say selling milk direct, you could set up maybe some sort of a fridge at the front and an honesty box and put in bottles into it, but that wasn't what you were about. You went down a pretty professional route from the outset. Like, the vending machine is a really good way of doing it, a labour-saving way of doing it. But explain to me how it works, how the logistics of filling milk into this vending machine and bottles, and there's a lot to it.
Yeah, so the first step is to pasteurise the milk. And then the next step is goes into big containers, sealed containers, and into the vending machine. So when the customer comes for the first time, they'll buy a reusable glass bottle. So the idea is it's a bottle for life. You're reducing the packaging, no plastic waste. And you take that bottle, put it into the milk vending machine, select what you want, whether it's a milk or a flavoured milk, and the vending machine will dispense it. And just wash the bottle and return the next time.
And the logistics then of the pasteurisation process, I suppose, getting the milk into that, moving that container into the other container, waiting for the milk to be pasteurised, that side of things, was that laboursome?
Initially when I started, I started with what they call a batch pasteuriser, so that was a pretty laboursome system, but since I opened back up this year, I invested in a new continuous flow pasteuriser, so that's a fully automated system. I would say the labour end of it is probably manageable. It's the biggest challenge for someone like myself with no experience around food or food production. I was dealing with all the compliance issues with the Department of Agriculture and all aspects of food safety. That was probably the biggest challenge for me.
Yeah, a lot of red tape, as with anything, no question about it. Then, as we said, that was the outset of it, and you started up and running, you were going well, and lots of people coming out to you, busy, busy, busy. Then you had an unfortunate incident last summer. Can you tell us what occurred at the premises?
Yeah, that was last October there, when two fellas broke in and vandalised both of the machines, just looking for money. And one of the machines was broken beyond repair, so I was out of production for about 11 months until September of this year, until I was able to get the new equipment. So it's all made to order equipment. So the vending machines came from the Czech Republic. The pasteurizer was built by a company in Limerick. So yeah, it just took a while to get back going again.
And you're back up and running now, and the equipment, as you said, you've invested a little bit more heavily in the equipment. It's not as laboursome in relation to pasteurisation. How are you finding it now? Because bear in mind, you're a full-time dairy farmer as well, which is a busy enough job in itself, and you're at this on top of it. Are there enough hours in the day, Paul?
There's probably not. It's probably one of the things we underestimated was the amount of time that went into the whole process. So my parents are involved in the farm and in the vending machine, and in April this year I had a guy start working with me, Ethan, so he's there full time looking after the cows and looking after the farm, and kind of allows me to deal with the vending machine and other things around that.
And obviously, Paul, I did a piece last week on winter milk. So in order to have supply for year-round, you were a spring calving dairy farmer, and you obviously had to go down the winter milk route now to have constant supply. So how are you finding the challenge of that, milking cows all year round?
Our milking parlour is, modern milking parlour, and facilities are pretty good as well. So I don't find it much of a challenge. I suppose you have to milk cows over Christmas. I suppose that's just anything that we hadn't been doing before.
Yeah, and you're getting used to it as you go. With the milk, you have a few different types of... There's milk, obviously, straightforward, conventional milk available. But the interesting part of it is you have flavoured milk as well. I thought this was an interesting angle to the business. Can you tell people what else they can get if they pop to you?
Over half the milk that sells from the vending machine will have flavours in it. So the most popular flavour is strawberry or chocolate, banana. Then every week I'll change, get a new flavour. There's about 50 different flavours available. So this week it's blueberry muffin and salted caramel.
It's an interesting angle, Paul, and I suppose it's one that people may not be familiar with, but say, for example, they're buying milk off you at the weekend, somebody from an urban setting, and they bring their children out and they get a litre, maybe a chocolate milk then, and children share it on the way home. A nice treat and a nice kind of additive to the whole experience. Are you finding families are coming out bottling up their milk, maybe from towns that they're not familiar with farms, and children are getting a bit of kick out of seeing it and buying the milk direct from the farmer?
I would, yeah. Especially on Sundays or Saturdays, they're the two busiest days. So I think it's a kind of a destination for families to go for two birds with one stone to buy milk and to do something to do with the novelty of filling their own milk.
Exactly, have a little activity. Down to the money side of things, Paul, and what are you charging for a litre of milk, may I ask?
So the milk is 1.70 a litre.
Yeah, so I would have said to you this time last year, you're going great and this is fantastic margins and revenue from the milk. But the way milk price is going now at the moment, like, you're probably, given your costs and given the time and everything goes into it, you're not making an absolute fortune just given the really, really, really good base price of milk as it is.
Yeah, it's hard to complain with the price of milk we're getting, but yeah, it does leave the margin tighter on that end. And I suppose a lot of consumers won't be able to... see the difference in the two types of milk. Like the milk we're selling at the moment, it's be over 4% protein. If you compare to standardised milk in the shop, it's about a little over 3. So it's like in relative value, we probably should be charging over €2 a litre, but yeah.
Yeah, you're trying to keep it competitive as well, but we understand, and it is one of those ones, putting a lot of work into it. Paul, we're going to have to leave it there. I have to say, I really enjoyed the chat about it from start to finish. A lot of work involved in this. Goes to show you how much there is in a farm business like this. But we wish you all the best with Bora Banya, Paul, and hopefully going from strength to strength. Many thanks for joining us.
Super, thank you.
Paul Malloy there, as we said, from Bora Banya. And a lot of work involved in something like that. You would think fairly straightforward, vending machine at the gate and fill it with milk and off you go, but not at all. A lot of work involved in it, and that unfortunate incident last year, but Paul is back stronger than ever. So Bora Banya. And you're very welcome back to Country Life here on Midlands 103. Now we're talking about farm safety, and I have David Meredith from the Be Safe programme online. David, many thanks for taking my call this evening.
Hi, MJ. Good evening.
Thanks for joining me, David. And the Be Safe programme. Now, we're going to talk about unsafe farming practices in a moment. But first, the Be Safe programme. What exactly is that, David, please, for our listeners?
Okay, so this is a four-year project, and it's funded by the Department of Agriculture as part of one of their research projects. And I'm leading it for Chagask, but it also includes colleagues in... University College Dublin, so UCD, from the School of Agriculture and also the Vet School. And it involves people from the University of Galway from their Department of Psychology.
And it's showing what farmers are doing or not doing, whatever the case may be. But your recent report shows that not enough farmers are doing the right thing. 57% of farmers are found to engage in unsafe farming practices. This concept of unsafe farming? Is there kind of a scale as to 1 to 10, 1 being very unsafe, 10 being not so unsafe, or is it just all deemed, if you're doing something maybe that's a little bit dangerous, it all falls under this ambit of unsafe?
No, your first guess at it is closer to the truth of it. So we asked farmers on a scale of 1 to 5, you know, where they would position themselves in relation to a set of practices. And it basically, if you put yourself at 1, it meant that it was not particularly safe. And if you were at 5, it could be very safe. But the way we developed these, and there were scenarios, so there were, we developed these as very short stories, a couple of sentences long. And we painted a picture of a common farming practice, and we identified these from looking at fatality reports. So we were able to find out what were some of the key things or key events that were resulting in fatalities on farms. And we used them then as the basis of developing these stories, these very short stories. So rather than saying to a farmer, do you plan on being safe tomorrow? Which the answer to it is yes. We all would answer yes to that question. We presented them with these stories and said, well, you know, have you ever done something like this yourself? And we take it from there, you know, in terms of trying to tease out some of the nuances around that. Because the, you know, asking that question, will you be safe tomorrow? The answer is yes. What we wanted to get to is a much more accurate understanding of what was really going on with farmers and why it is not possible to be safe all the time, so that we can then take that information and try and develop training or education programs or other resources that can support farmers in the future to be safer.
Yeah, the sentences was a good angle, all right. It's the only way to get the information, really. Very interesting quote from the research, and it's from one of your colleagues in Chagas, that farmers, they engage in practices that are unsafe, as this is what they believe other farmers and people they respect expect them to do. So it's kind of like farmers are almost justifying it by maybe going into a field with a bull or whatever the case may be, because they kind of go, well, look, people kind of think this is what I'm going to do anyway.
Well, there's a little bit in that, but what's happening here, so we were asking farmers, like, what do you think good farmers do? So when we use that term, good farmers, I think most of us could think of a good farmer in our own community. And, you know, we might look at them in terms of they're a very tidy farmer, or they get great yields, or they have lovely animals, or whatever it happens to be. But, you know, we can think about a good farmer from that point of view. But we were asking the farmers who responded to this particular piece of work, and there was almost 400 of them. We were asking them what they thought good farmers think about safety. And the general response was, well, we actually think good farmers are not safe and don't take safety seriously. And this is important because it reflects the culture as perceived by the respondents of our survey. It reflects a culture in which safety is not considered to be a priority or not considered to be important. And if we're going to make any change here, that's got to change. We need to get the culture right so that people expect other people to be safe, and other farmers basically saying, well, you know, safety is part of the job. And we do it this way because it is safe.
I feel, though, David, I know I wasn't part of the respondents, and obviously you went through this in detail, that there is a different culture, though, than there once was. Like, when you do go into a farm now, you know, you're not going to see doors hanging off hinges. You're not going to see PTO shafts left exposed. You still will. There's no question about it. You will still. But it's not as bad as it once was. Like, do you feel there is a bit of a movement and a bit of a shift away from unsafe practices?
Yes, and this is something that was commented on by people from right across the spectrum today. So we had people from the Health and Safety Authority, we also had farmers, and we had others, farm advisors as well, who made the exact same point, that we have seen a big change in how farms are set up, but more importantly in terms of the behaviours of farmers. And people are clearly engaged with farming safely. They've gotten the message. They've always understood that farming is a dangerous occupation, but it shouldn't cost somebody their life or their livelihood to put food on the table for someone else. And that message has really gotten across, and I think it resonates with a lot of families around the country.
Yeah, 100%. David, I'm going to say many thanks for joining me. Your Be Safe National Farm Safety Conference is taking place next Wednesday. Your event was this morning. And that's what you were speaking about there. But we'll have to leave it at that because I'm just out of time on it. And I'm going to say many thanks. And a little piece of advice maybe for farmers going, David. One little change they could maybe make, so just something small to help them farm more safely.
Well, in terms of behaviour, it's about looking at that thing that's broken or needs to be fixed, and rather than putting it off, making time for it. Right? You know, saying, right, I'm going to make time for that and do it this weekend or whatever it is. And it's just pick that one thing that has been nagging at you for ages that you know needs to be fixed. Do that one thing and fix that. And mentally, that'll be good for them. But also, it'll help make things safer around the farm.
Yeah, 100%. Excellent advice. Thanks, David.
Thanks, MJ.
David Murray there from the Be Safe programme. And let's all take that one on board. Everybody says, right, one thing we're going to do to make the farmyard a little bit safer going forward. Whatever it is, you know what it is yourself, and maybe just take action on it. As David said, good for you physically and mentally. And you're very welcome back to Country Life here on Midlands 103. Now, I have Leonard Green on the line. Leonard, I'm going to say many thanks for joining me on the programme here this evening.
Thanks very much, MJ. Thanks for having me on.
You're more than welcome, Leonard. You're a Westmead man with a snack business for dogs. Not something you hear every day. So let's turn back the clock, Leonard, and come to the start of this. When did you say to yourself, right, I need to make a healthy snack for dogs?
I've been thinking about it for some time, but it was the end of 2011, really, is kind of when I started, MJ.
And your trade, your initial trade, what did you work at firstly in life?
A butcher, apprentice butcher. I started butchering when I was 15, so I loved it, you know, I loved the meat. I left school at 15 and I got a job with Tormey's there in Mullingar, and I was with them for 3.5 years, so... Yeah, I loved every day of it, to be honest.
Yeah, so the butcher background then, and the meat snacks. So your business is called Pure Meat Snacks, SNAX, for retail customers, and then people can buy them online. It's called tonictreat.com. But the Pure Meat Snacks, this is obviously your butcher background, looking at the type of snacks that were out there for dogs and saying they're just not great.
Yeah, very much so. You know, when I started out, like, I knew I was never able to go to be competing against the big guys in terms of volume, but I really wanted to make something different, something special, and that's what I went to go about doing. And thankfully, after the years that I'm at it, it looks like I have done that, you know.
Yeah, and as I said at the outset of the program, Leonard, so farmers are always looking for the best feed for their animals, high energy feeds where there's going to be good weight gain, good thrive, it's going to be the best of the best, and we have optimal nutrition consultants now in a lot of the big companies and whatnot. However, the dog is in probably nearly every home in the country, I'd say, after lockdown. There's a dog, I don't know what the percentage is, but it must be extremely high now. And more often than not, even though dog is a part of the family, not usually fed the best food.
Sometimes not. Like, there's a lot of over-processed food out there with very questionable ingredients. And for me, it's about going back to nature, you know. Dogs are part of nature, like we're part of nature, and we should give them nature to nature, you know. I don't believe in over-processing. And the criteria I set, MJ, was if it didn't bring a benefit to the dog, then it didn't get into my treats. Mm. And it just...
And the base ingredients then, you're talking grass-fed beef, but you also have, there's one with seaweed, which I find it very interesting, a big push on seaweed in agri-produce. What was the thought process on this one, Leonard?
Yeah, initially it was pure beef, grass-fed beef, and then I from the research I was doing, I started using seaweeds, Irish seaweeds. Like, we have an abundance of, like, fantastic seaweeds out there, huge volumes of it, and very, very, very interesting material, you know, very interesting ingredients. I would say that they're medicinal, and, like, they can be used on the land and, you know, used, you know, in feed, and they are really remarkable. We're really only starting to rediscover the properties of seaweed. So, yeah, there's, like, a lot of research going on, and it's good stuff, you know.
Yeah, you have essentially four main products now. So you have your original and seaweed, and then the next one is Dental Plus. So what's the benefits of this one, Leonard?
Yeah, so, well, I suppose in the name, it's the oral health of the dog, but I wanted to give something more. I just didn't want, you know, I wanted to give something more. So it's like the oral health, but really what I'm kind of looking at is the whole digestive system in the dog, the microbiome, and how we can help the whole animal through the gut system. That's really the crux of what I'm kind of about and what I'm doing. Like, the beef is the super tasty bit. The dogs love it, and the smell of it, like their nose is like a laboratory analyzer. So that's the way of getting the functional ingredients down into the gut system. And when it goes into the gut, then, you know, the gut delivers them to the different parts of the body that it needs, and vitamins and minerals and the functionality of the ingredients.
Next up then, we have Joint Aid Plus. So obviously dogs living longer lives than they did, and arthritic problems and joint problems occurring with them. This is going to help it?
Yeah, absolutely. And not only older dogs, like fast-growing breeds, like of the larger breeds, they can also benefit from the glucosamine. It's actually kind of like recommended, you know, that like only actually last Sunday I met a girl at a market in Dublin with a Bernese Mountain Dog, 1 year old, with serious hip problems, because it was for a Bernese. It was a very tall dog for a Bernese, and you know, they can benefit even in the fast growing dogs, the big dogs. They can benefit, their bone structure can benefit from getting the glucosamine and clindroitin in into their diet, you know.
And another very interesting one, Leonard, ones that farmers will be hugely interested in, well used to worming animals throughout the course of the year, and it can be the bane of farmers' lives in a wet year, but you have an anti-worm plus snack.
Yeah.
This is hugely interesting, Leonard, but this is one of the ones where it's like an old family recipe. If I'm talking to an Italian now about the tomato sauce, he'll only tell me the recipe of this if you'll kill me. Is that it?
Yeah, no, it's intellectual property, I'm afraid, MJ. I don't disclose the active ingredient. We know, like, I got assistance from a professor from NUI in the developing of that product. It's a unique product within, well, I think my treats, even within the European market, are quite unique in terms of the bar that I've set in terms of standards. But, yeah, it's very potent. The active ingredient is very potent and very safe. So it's a vermifuge. So when it's ingested, if the gut system contains parasitic worms, it destroys them and it flushes them out of the system. And as well, like if for instance, if it's a tapeworm that's attached to the stomach lining, it'll dislodge the head part and flush that out as well. That's very important in terms of, you know, secondary infection. You don't want to be destroying it and leaving that in there, you know. So, yeah, we 2015 was a very tough, very rough year, the first half of it, for processing reasons. It took a long time to perfect the drying, you know. But during 2015, I discovered just how potent my anti-wormer is, because we have a local, you know, hunt here who have hounds, and I gave them product. And they came back to me with, like, they were very, very surprised, you know. They'd never seen it, happening before, because they give it to their pups, and they came in the next day and the evidence was on the ground, you know.
Yeah, fantastic stuff. Leonard, it's hugely interesting, I have to say, and you're a man who's hugely passionate about it. You know your area upside down and inside out. Christmas is coming up, and no doubt your products are going to be a big one for the Christmas stockings. There's so many dogs everywhere now, and everyone's talking about them. I presume you're going to sell for the Christmas period?
Hopefully, yeah, absolutely. That's what we were hoping to do, to sell more of it, you know, because I'm very small. I make it in small amounts, small batches. But as I say, what I do is very, very good. So, yeah, of course, I'd like to grow it, you know. But I've been kind of growing organically bit by bit. It's taken, like MJ, it's taken a long, long time to perfect the drying aspect. So I'm really, really happy with the presentation now. For the last 12 months, we've really cracked that, the presentation of the product. So
yeah, I'm actually looking at them in front of me here, and I see the meat snacks and the different packs they're in. You have different colours on them. Yeah, I think the product looks really cool. On that, Leonard, I'm going to have to say goodbye for this evening. I want to say thank you very much for joining me. We wish you all the best with tonictreat.com and your pure meat snacks. .ie, the same product, just available different through retail and direct, and hopefully you go from strength to strength with them, Leonard. Many thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much, MJ. Good evening.
Leonard Green there from, as we said, Meat Snacks, puremeatsnacks.ie, and if you want to buy them online, it's tonictreat.com. And some very, very interesting elements to that product, I have to say, with the anti-wormer and with the seaweed and the grass-fed beef, and a huge market for it, no doubt whatsoever. Now, that's it for this evening's programme. I want to thank all my guests this evening. Leonard Green there from County Westmeath, David Murr that's talking about farm safety, Paul Malloy from Boora Banya in County Offaly, and Siobhan Walsh from County Laois talking about the open day on the Tullamore farm tomorrow. If you're interested in that, you meet at Mucklagh Hall at 11 a.m. That is it for this evening's programme. If you are interested in the podcast of this programme, just log on wherever you get your podcast and type MJ space Cleary, C-L-E-R-Y, into the space bar, and we'll pop up and you can listen at your convenience. We are also repeated on Sunday morning at 7 a.m. until 8 a.m. and I'll be back with you this time next week. As always, Joe Cooney is up next with Country Roads. So good night and God bless.